Like to welcome everybody to our 16th annual pre-Shavuot lecture series. Since we moved into the building in 2002, we felt it was a great way to prepare for Kabbalah Satorah by having shiurim, serious learning, as we get ready for Kabbalah Satorah. This year, it is the 50th year of the recapturing of Yerushalayim, so we felt that it will be very appropriate as we got ready for Shavuos and towards Yom Yerushalayim that all of this shiurim would be focused on a different aspect of Yerushalayim. This series is generously sponsored by the Hagler family. It's called the Joseph M. Hagler Lecture Series. Tonight, I mean, all the shiurim are l'zecher Rav Yosef Mordechai ben Ritzvi Yehuda. Tonight, in a moment, we'll hear from Rabbi Leibowitz, but next Thursday night, Rabbi Weinberger will be coming to speak about the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and in a week from Wednesday night, Rav Goldberg will be coming to speak at night, Bilu Yerushalayim, Yerech Barachan, and Tashu Hal. There are many, many sponsors for the individual shiur. Tonight's shiur is sponsored by the Freeling family in honor of Yosef Ben Zvi, Harry Ederson, Zvi Ben Yosef, thank you. Zvi Ben Yosef, Harry Ederson. Okay, we worked on that. And that is tonight's shiur is being sponsored by the Freeling so generously. Many other people have sponsored anonymously and don't want their names mentioned for other reasons. And the other shiur also are sponsored by many other people. Rabbi Leibowitz is right behind me and not letting me introduce him as properly, but really he doesn't need an introduction. We have been in a Rebbe in the yeshiva for many, many years. To see an introduction, just go to YouTube and watch Rabbi Leibowitz honored by DRS, and you'll see plenty. Here is Rabbi Leibowitz.
Am I projecting without the mic? Yes? Okay. Like Rabbi Friedman? Project. Okay. I can't really explain it, but I'm nervous. I don't know why I'm nervous to speak in DRS. I speak in DRS twice every single day and have been doing so for the last 18 years. Bereshus Avi Mori, my father is here, and Bereshus Mori Virabi, Rabbi Kamenetsky. You know, it's very hard for someone my age to appreciate what exactly we're celebrating this year, 50 years of having Yerushalayim back, because 50 years ago, I was not yet born. It was 10 years before my birth. I have a little gray in my beard, but I'm really not yet 50 years old. And I started like trying to put myself into that time period in history to appreciate, to try to get some flavor, some sense of what it was. And the more you read first-hand accounts, and you're going to hear in a few weeks, for those who come to hear Morenu Harav Willig Shlita is, I'm sure, going to tell the story of what it was like when he was studying in Kerem B'Yavne that year, and being in Eretz Yisrael, and being in Yerushalayim, as all of this was unfolding. I just found recently, in fact, I was cleaning up some books in my house, and I found a book written by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. And the book was a journal that Rabbi Feldman kept in 1967. Rabbi Feldman became the rabbi of a shul in Atlanta, Georgia in 1952. After 15 years, he took a sabbatical. And he spent the sabbatical in Israel in 1967, lecturing in Bar Ilan. And he kept a journal throughout that time period, throughout the month of June in 1967. He published that journal in 1968. Somehow it ended up on my shelf. I have no idea. There's an inscription from Rabbi Feldman to somebody whose name I don't recognize. So if you're missing it, please let me know. But I've been reading it and just trying to get into the mood of what it must have felt like at that time. And you know, there's a word from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. The Navi tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he looks out for Klal Yisrael, he uses two different phrases. He's Mashkiach min achalonos and he's Meitzitz min acharakim. He's looking through the window, and he's also peering through the cracks. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter has, a beautiful vart to explain the difference between looking through the window and peering through the cracks. He says, when a father is looking out at his children playing, or a mother at her children playing, through the window, a large window, the parent can see the child, and the child can see the parent. Bizman shebeis hamigdash hayakayim. When we had a beis hamigdash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mashkiach min achalonos. We came liros viliraos, the Gemara says, to see when we were olah l'regel and to be seen. Hashem saw us, we saw him. There were miracles that happened every day in the Beis HaMikdash, and even absent the miracles, the inspiration of Avodah, of Kohanim B'Avodasam, Leviim B'Duchanam, it was real, it was something that we could all appreciate. In times of Galus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is no longer Mashkiach Min HaChalonos. He is Meitzitz Min HaCharakim. Meitzitz Min HaCharakim, if someone is peering through a crack, they can see everything on the other side of the wall, but you can't see them. And that's been the story of our galus. HaKadosh Baruch Hu still sees us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still paying attention to us. But so often we haven't seen him. The impression I get from reading all of the accounts of 1967 was that it was a moment in history where we felt that even though it was not Geula the way we imagined it, with the Beis HaMikdash coming and landing on Har HaBayis and everything, and people coming flying on the wings of eagles, it wasn't the way we always pictured it, but it was a moment where people felt that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not Meitzitz Min HaCharakim, but was in fact Mashkiach Min HaChalonos. That he was actually looking at us in a way that we can see him as well. And that's an incredibly inspiring thing. In fact, I just this past Shabbos, my wife and I, my family and I, hosted Rebbetzin Lam. Rebbetzin Lam, whose husband was Rabbi Maurice Lam, Zichrono Livracha. Rabbi Maurice Lam, when he was a rabbi in the largest shul in the West Coast for many years, I forgot the name, Beth Jacob, I think is the name of the shul in Beverly Hills. And when he retired, he didn't retire to Florida, to Israel, he retired to North Woodmere. I have no explanation whatsoever for why he did that, but he retired to North Woodmere. So he passed away about a year ago, and we just had the Rebbetzin over for lunch, and she was telling us that she was going through some of her things, and she found the garment that she wore when she visited the Kotel for the first time in 1967. The Lambs went to Eretz Yisrael in 1967, and she visited the Kotel, and she tore Kriya. They went with Rav Goren, and Rav Goren told them they have to tear Kriya, and she tore Kriya, and she has that torn garment. And the way she was describing it, just with the emotion that she was describing it, you get a sense of what that was like, and just how valuable this is, that we have HaKotel Biyadeinu. And maybe even most poignantly, for me at least, one of the things about being in DRS for so many years is that you get to hear a lot of guest speakers and a lot of interesting perspectives on a number of different things. A number of years ago, this is going back a while, I think it may have been in the old building, Rabbi Kamenetsky had his father speak on Yom Yerushalayim. And Rabbi Kamenetsky's father was describing also what it was like, because Rabbi Kamenetsky's also too young to remember what it was like. And his father was describing what it was like. And his father told us, you know what your menahel, at that time he was not yet Rosh HaYeshiva, you know what your menahel's name is? And we said, yeah, Rabbi Yisrael Kamenetsky. No, his name is Yisrael Yair, because he was born in 1967. And what else would you name a child after experiencing what we just experienced in 1967? The Gemara says, Kishmo Kein Hu, that a person's name has an impact on who he becomes. I think that's certainly the case over here, that a person's name given with the inspiration of a sense of Hashras Hashchina, the inspiration of a sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is such a real part of our lives, and that name reflects itself in everything that our Rebbe does. But my task tonight is not to talk about any of that, because that's for the next like 5 weeks. My task tonight is to talk about the halachos of Yerushalayim. So I was thinking, what are the halachos of Yerushalayim? I actually have a sefer at home, several svarim at home, all about the halachos of Yerushalayim. And I was thinking as follows, that maybe we'll approach the halachos, we're going to limit it, not the halachos of Yerushalayim, not going to get into Maaser Sheni and Kachum Kalev and all that. Maybe we'll limit the conversation to the halachos of visiting the Kotel. The way that we see it, the way that we have it ever since we've had the opportunity to do so for the last 50 years, and maybe through learning some of these halachos, we'll gain a little bit more of an appreciation. Because sometimes, you know, we take things for granted. We're able, thank God, to go to Israel all the time, and yes, we still make sure that we go to the Kotel. Some people are still makbid to make sure it's the first stop, to make sure that they go to the Kotel. But sometimes we seem to take it for granted. You know, it's a place to see and be seen, but not by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by all of our friends on a Friday night, a Kabbalah Shabbos, and it's a nice social event. And sometimes we lack an appreciation for what it is. So maybe through the halacha, we can begin to appreciate what it is. So what I wanted to go through is, imagine you're walking toward the Kotel. What are the halachos that present themselves as you get closer and closer? You know, there's Rav Soloveitchik had a beautiful idea. The Mishnah tells us that there are Eser Kedushosein. There are 10 levels of Kedusha. Eretz Yisrael has a certain level of Kedusha. Then the Arei Yehuda have a higher level of Kedusha in Yerushalayim. And it keeps going up and up and up and up till the Kodesh HaKadosh is the highest level of Kedusha. And the Mishnah identifies what's unique about the Kedusha of each place. So the Mishnah says, ooh, Eretz Yisrael, you know what's unique about the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael? Omer and Shtei HaLechem. You could bring the Karban Omer and the Shtei HaLechem, the Karban for Shavuos, from grains that grow in Eretz Yisrael. That's what's unique about Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Soloveitchik said, you know how many halachas there are about Eretz Yisrael? Omer and Shtei, what about Trumos and Maisos and Shemitah and everything else? Omer and Shtei HaLechem? So Rav Soloveitchik explained that there are two different Kedushos of Eretz Yisrael. This is a classic Brisker explanation. Tzvei Dinim. There are two dinim in the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. There's Eretz Yisrael, as far as Eretz Yisrael is concerned. But then there's a second level of Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, which emanates from Kedushas HaMikdash. That the Mikdash is the source of the Kedusha, and it impacts the environment around it. And the closer you are to the Mikdash, the higher that level of Kedusha. So the Har HaBayis, a high level of Kedusha. A little bit further out, the Yerah HaTika, higher level of Kedusha, a little bit lower than that. And further out, Eretz Yisrael still has a trace of Kedushas HaMikdash. So when the Mishnah wants to identify the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, as far as Kedushas HaMikdash is concerned, which is clearly what the Mishnah is doing, it's building up 10 levels of Kedusha to bring you to the Kodesh HaKadosh, and that's what it's doing. It identifies karbanos that can only be brought from that which grows in Eretz Yisrael. Omer and Shtei Alecha. There are karbanos that can only, it doesn't identify Truma, Maisa, Shemitah. That's just regular Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. We're focused on Kedushas HaMikdash. But the idea that Kedusha isn't just present in a place, it emanates from a place, and it affects the entire environment around it, and further out, is a profound idea. And I thought that's what got me thinking. When I heard, you know, that applies, for example, to Beis HaKnesses as well. It was traditionally understood that the most chashuv seat in the Beis HaKnesses is what they call the Mizrach Vant, right? When you sit by the Mizrach. Why? Because the Mizrach was where the Aron Kodesh is. And the Kedusha's Beis HaKnesses emanates from the Aron Kodesh. And the Kedusha continues from there. So that's what got me thinking about this model. You're going closer and closer to the Kotel. What are the halachos that are relevant when you're going closer and closer to the Kotel? So maybe we'll take them one at a time. So as you're walking, you go through Shar Yafo, and let's say you don't go through the Shuk, you go around the long way, which is recommended to go around the long way, and you finally turn around that corner, and you see the Kotel. So first thing, right then and there, there's a halacha. No, what's the halacha? Tear Kriya. So that's the very first halacha, is tearing Kriya. It's actually not the first halacha. The first halacha comes before that. The first halacha is to make sure you plan to visit the Kotel. That's also a halacha. Now, why is that a halacha? The value of going to the Kotel is spoken about in the most poetic terms by Rishonim, Achronim. You know, there's a Klei Yakar in Parshas Lech Lecha that says that anyone who's mistakel b'makom hakadosh, if you look at this holy place, miyad nislabesh ruach tahara u'kedusha, you're immediately covered with a sense of tahara and kedusha. The Medrash famously tells us that the Shechina never left the Kosel HaMa'aravi. In fact, the Chayei Adam composed an entire tefillah that one is supposed to recite when they approach the Kotel. Another tefillah for when you go to Yerushalayim. He has entire tefillos for these experiences. He thought one should be so overcome with emotion that it has to be formulated in tefillah. But practically speaking, so you planned your visit. You go and you see the Kotel. Step one, tearing Kriya. And we'll go through them afterwards in more detail. Next step, okay, you tore Kriya, you get to the Kotel Plaza, right? At what point do you have to start behaving like you're in a shul? Meaning, at what point do you stop using your cell phone? At what point do you, put on your paper yarmulke? At what point do you have to start behaving like you're actually in a kedusha space HaKnesses? At what point do you have to treat it with the dignity of not using it as a shortcut to get from one place to another? Then, okay, you get closer to the wall, and the next thing, you're at the wall. How close can you get? Can you put your fingers into the wall? Are you allowed to lean on the wall? Are you allowed to benefit from the wall? Are you allowed to stand right by the wall? Okay, let's say you get close enough to the wall that you see some notes fell out of the wall on the ground, because there's this minhag that people put notes in the wall. Are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to put notes in the wall? Is there any limitation on that? What if you see a note on the ground? Can you leave it there? Does it have kedusha? Do you have to stick it back into the wall? Do you just throw it out? What do you do with the notes? And this was a real problem. You know, there's a rav. I never realized this as a child, but apparently there always was a rabbi of the Kotel. The Kotel is the biggest shul, the most important shul in the world. I mean, that's what it functions as now. And there's a rabbi. There's a rabbi of the shul. There's a rabbi of the Kotel. He happens to be the Rav of the Kotel and the Mekomos HaKadoshim, several other holy places. His name is Rav Rabinovich. He's also a political figure somewhat. And he published Shalos and Tshuvas. His Shalos and Tshuvas, the questions that you get when you're the rabbi of the Kotel, are different than the questions that you get when you're the rabbi of any other shul. They're completely unique. So, for example, he has a shaila about what do we do when the notes start getting so overwhelming, they're all falling out of the wall. So obviously we got to clean them. So what they wanted to do is guys who learned in Yeshiva HaKotel and Nativ Aryeh can tell you that every once in a while, once a month or so, at like 2:00 in the morning, they take this giant hose and they clean them all out of the wall. And that's how they get rid of the notes. And they wonder, are you allowed to do that? Is there any kedusha? These are people's tefillos. Are you allowed to just wash them away? Can you do that with your shul's old sidurim? So why would it be any different? These are tefillos that people have. So that's the next step. Then, you're so inspired by the Kotel that you decide that it's not enough to come to the Kotel and appreciate the inspiration of the Kotel. I want to bring some of it home with me. And they had this problem as well. Also a tshuva from Rav Rabinovich. People would take a little chisel. Now I would imagine you can't get past the metal detector with it, but they chisel off a little piece of the Kotel, and they put it in a nice frame in their house, about Imesh Kachech Yerushalayim, and it would be a nice conversation piece. So are you allowed to do that? Can you, I guess I'd give it away if I phrase it like this, can you steal a piece of the Kotel? So that's the next step. Then you go up the wall a little bit, and you notice as you look up the wall, there's like pieces of grass growing out of the Kotel. Now you'll notice, if you've ever seen, and I'm sure we've all seen artwork of the Kotel, they tend to exaggerate that part of it. There's more grass in the artwork than there is, like in our mind's eye, I guess it's just startling for us to see grass growing out of the Kotel. So when we draw it, we draw more than there actually is. So there's grass growing out of the Kotel. Rav Rabinovich has a tshuva about this. What could the question be about the grass? Well, they have a tradition going back to Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. Don't touch it. Leave the grass alone. If something's growing out of the Kotel, it's growing in Hegdish, you're not supposed to touch it. Great, no problem, we could do that. Until they realized that some small pieces of stone were falling off of the wall. And that's kind of dangerous. So they brought a structural engineer. And he said, yeah, you got to cut the grass, otherwise you're going to continue to have pieces falling off of the wall. So now they had a shaila. What do we do? Are we allowed to cut the grass? After all, the Medrash says that Hashem promised us that the Kotel is never going to be destroyed. So a structural engineer may say one thing, but we have a medrash that says it's never going to be destroyed. So when Rav Rabinovich posed this shaila to Rav Zilberstein, Rav Eliashiv's son-in-law, he said, you know, there is the medrash, but I should note pieces have been falling already. So however we explain the medrash, you know, we're like, we have to deal with the reality as well. And if you do cut the grass, what do you do with it? Is it Seamus? Is it like, you know, someone just asked me just now that they have, that a shul, like mamish, five minutes before I started, someone came over to me and said there was a shul in Queens that was using, as an Aron Kodesh, they were using a gun safe for their Aron Kodesh. And then they got a second Sefer Torah, so it didn't fit anymore. So now they want to, someone who has guns wants to use it as a gun safe again. So can you just do that? Can you just take something that was holy and that had holiness to it and just use it for something else? Halb had that shaila. When they moved from the Long Beach campus to the Woodmere campus, there was this large Aron Kodesh that they had. Very large Aron Kodesh, not particularly beautiful. The nicer one, I think, got destroyed in Sandy. It was just a very large Aron Kodesh. So they're not going to bring it to the Woodmere campus. What do you do with it? You can't just get rid of something that's holy. So how much holiness does it have? How much holiness does this grass have? Does it have any holiness? And then you finally get up and over the wall, let's say. That's not the best way to go. If you do plan on going over the wall, it's not up and over, but you get over the wall. And now you have another question. Are you allowed to be there? What do you have to do to be there? Where are you allowed to be when you're there? So at each step, there are halachas to discuss. So in the time we have allotted, let's discuss some of these halachos relating to going to the Kotel. So let's start with tearing Kriya. So it is explicit in Shulchan Aruch, in Tavkuf Samach Aleph, that when a person sees the Arei Yehuda B'Churbanah, one has to tear Kriya. When you see the Arei Yehuda in their destroyed state, you tear Kriya and you say, Arei Kachcha HaYamidbar. And then a second chiyuv of kriya. When you see Yerushalayim b'churbana, you see Yerushalayim destroyed again. Tear kriya. Tzion ha'isa midbar shemama. Tear kriya. And then when you see the makom hamigdash b'churbana, the migdash not rebuilt, again tear kriya. Three separate chiyuvim of kriya. So why have you never heard of anybody that tore kriya three times? We only people who have done it, but they do it only once. So when it comes to the Ari Yehuda, there's a fantastic sefer called Sefer Eretz Yisrael, written by Rav Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky. Rav Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky was most famous for his sefer on Avelus. He wrote the classic work on Avelus called Gesher HaChayim, but he wrote a sefer called Sefer Eretz Yisrael, and he had all the minhagim of Eretz Yisrael, and he explains that we don't tear Kriya on Arei Yehuda anymore, either because we don't know exactly their borders or something else. He has a variety of explanations, but that's clearly, everyone agrees that the minhag is we don't tear Kriya on Arei Yehuda. What about Yerushalayim? So the Beis Yosef explains, you know why you tear Kriya on Yerushalayim? Beis Yosef says three words. Yishma'elim Moshlim Aleihem. The Yishma'elim are in control of the city. And if the Yishma'elim are in control of the city, we tear Kriya over that. It's our holy city. So then the question arose, okay, post-1967, do you tear Kriya on Yerushalayim? Major machlokas haposkim. So this is one of those areas. Normally we like to assume that one's political viewpoints don't affect, hopefully too much, their piskei halacha. Right? Is Yerushalayim still in a state of destruction based on who is in control of Yerushalayim? So it's very, very hard to look at Yerushalayim today and say, it's desolate. I mean, spend the night in the Waldorf and tell me, you know, that it's desolate. That's not really Yerushalayim. Even inside the walls of the old city, very hard to say that it's desolate. In fact, there was a whole controversy after 1967. What should we do on Tisha B'Av about the Tefillah of Nachem? You ever read the Tefillah of Nachem that we say in Mincha Tisha B'Av? It describes Yerushalayim that we don't know, that I don't know. It describes Yerushalayim that bears no resemblance to the Yerushalayim as we know it. Does it still make sense to say it? And there was a big dispute about that, a big debate. So there is also a debate about whether Yerushalayim is still called B'Churbana. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in the Tshuva, nowadays Yishma'elim are not Moshlim Aleihem. The Yishma'elim do not control Yerushalayim, and therefore we don't tear Kriya on Yerushalayim anymore. It's interesting. Most of the posts do not raise, well, one of those issues they do. We'll get to it in a second. Rav Vosner in Shevet Alevi Right? What do you mean that the Yishmaelim are no longer Moshal in Yerushalayim? It's even worse. Now the Israeli government, they're good for nothing. Sonei Adas, v'chulei v'chulei. You can imagine how he goes on. So he says, of course, you got to still tear Kriya. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach also says you still tear Kriya, but not because of his opinions about the government. He says we still tear Kriya because we do not have the ability to get rid of Avodah Zarah from Yerushalayim. We don't really have full control. On a certain level, it's still an international city, and it's still a city that we can't just do as we would like, al pi haTorah. And certainly, as Yehuda just said, the Har HaBayis is not something that we could just do whatever we want with the Har HaBayis. So there is that level of Churban, and therefore it would still require Kriya. Most people that you've seen probably have not torn Kriya on Yerushalayim. We only tear Kriya. Most people typically have the minhag. I think they say when the Stipler visited the Kotel, he would look down. He wouldn't look to see Yerushalayim till he actually got to the Kotel. That's great if you're the Stipler and you have like an entourage that could take you there. Otherwise, you'll bump into people. So he and that way, when he opened his eyes, he was at the Kotel already, so he only had to tear the Kriya on the Kotel. Okay, that was the Stipler's Eitzah. But tearing Kriya is a real thing, and it's something that people should do. I remember it used to be the shtick that people would like sell their shirt. Like two friends would trade, you know, I'll sell you your shirt and your payment will be my shirt. So I can't tear someone else's shirt, so I'm not going to tear Kriya. And aside from the fact that it doesn't work because it's not a serious sale. I mean, imagine, you sold your shirt to your friend for $1, right? So now he's wearing your shirt. And that's why he's not going to tear Kriya on it. So what does he do? You see, the next moment, he turns around to someone else and says, hey, I'll sell you the shirt for $5. So what's your reaction when you hear him say that? Well, you can't sell my shirt. Well, your shirt, you just sold it to me for $1. You're obviously, the whole sale is a joke. Sometimes, you know, especially when trying to effect a halachic sale, one has to be very, very careful when trying to effect a halachic sale. There are ways to do it to show that it's actually serious. You know, we always think, Mechiras Chametz, oh, that's a joke. It's really not a joke. Mechiras Chametz is like, it's a very serious thing. A woman emailed me this year, I sell my Chametz to my housekeeper, so we're not going to be selling Chametz through you this year because I'm just going to sell it to my housekeeper. That way, she can eat Chametz while she's cleaning in our house because it's all hers. So that's highly problematic. You know how many kinyanim we do in order to make a mechira? So to just do a mechira, to just stop, you know, to just decide that you're selling your shirt, probably it doesn't work. And even if it does work, it seems so odd to me to try to avoid this mitzvah. Meaning, if anything, we need to increase our sensitivity to the fact that we're in galus. This is the most comfortable galus we've ever been in. So it's very important for a Jew to remember that we're in galus. Things like tearing kriya are halachos that matter, and they're really helpful for us. And kedai hu churban beis elokeinu. The churban habayis is important enough that it's worthy of a kriya. One Talmud once said to me, "All my shirts are Brooks Brothers shirts." I said, "If you could afford for all your shirts to be Brooks Brothers shirts, you can afford to tear one of them. Take your oldest Brooks Brothers shirt and tear that shirt." I don't think you know. It is an interesting question, though, if you don't buy your own shirts. For many of the Talmidim, you know, you're not paying for them. So you probably do need to get permission from your parents. And this, the Poskim discussed this explicitly, that you should get permission. If you're not buying your own clothing because you're being supported by someone else, you need permission. You can't just go around ripping someone else's clothing and then say, "Oh, Mom, I need a new shirt." Well, don't go ripping your old ones, and you're not gonna need a new shirt. This chiv of kriya applies to women as well. Obviously, like any time a woman tears kriya, anytime anybody tears kriya, we should make sure that it's done in a tenua way, that there's a beged underneath. By ketanim, whether children have to tear kriya, it seems that the minhag is that children do not. You know, when a child, Rachmana Lestan, is an avel, they tear kriya mipnei agmas nefesh, that it makes people so sad to see a child in avelus, and it enhances the feeling of the loss. So we do kriya mipnei agmas nefesh. But when it's over a loss of the community, and it's over the Churban HaBayis, seeing a child with a torn shirt doesn't have any more of an impact on us than seeing an adult with a torn shirt. It's heartbreaking when you know that he tore his shirt because it's his parent that he just lost. It's not as heartbreaking when he's just tearing kriya because of the Churban. So that's as far as the kriya goes. So now a person has a torn shirt, you're allowed to, the post can say you're allowed to change the shirt that day. You don't have to tear the new shirt that you put on. It's not like avelus on a relative, where even if you put on a new shirt that day, if you change it out afterwards, you'd have to tear the other one as well. No, you don't have to do that. You can change your shirt afterwards. So now you get to the kotel. So now you're at the kotel. People tell me Rav Nevin Sal is makbid, that he doesn't go too close. He doesn't go near the kotel. So why is he makbid not to go near the kotel? I'm not sure. I didn't see an explanation. But I think Rabbi Farber was telling me that he's choshesh that the wall underground, you know, the plaza is built pretty high up on the wall underground, it's on somewhat of an incline. So if you get really close to the kotel, you're sort of over the wall in its lowest points. Okay, maybe, maybe not. But also, there's an old debate going on for many, many years, which has pretty much been settled, but there were people that were not sure, what was this the wall of? Is this the wall of the Beis HaMikdash? Or is this the wall of Har HaBayis? Now, if it's the wall of Har HaBayis, so good, stay on the right side of it, and you're okay, you don't have any problems. But if it's the wall of the Azara, then when you go right near the wall, you're actually on the Har HaBayis. And that's problematic for a person who's Tameh, which is an issue we'll get to, God willing, soon. But as far as just getting near the wall, so let's assume it's the wall, as we now know for a fact, that it's the wall of the Har HaBayis. You're allowed to be near the wall. What about sticking your fingers in? Why are people makbid not to stick their fingers in the wall? Someone sent me, last time I spoke about something like this, a picture of Rav Asher Weiss by the Kotel, with just hugging the wall, with his face and arms all over the wall. So apparently he's not so makbid about this issue. But why is it? What's the concern? So there's a notion called bia b'miktzas shma bia, that even if you partially enter a rishus, it's considered as if you've entered. And therefore, if you're tameh and you're partially entering into the Har HaBayis, because maybe the thickness of the wall is already considered, we don't know. It's a wall that's supposed to separate the Har HaBayis from outside the Har HaBayis. So maybe that kedusha starts on the outer surface of the wall. So if you stick your finger in, you're already encroaching on the area that has that kedusha. The pashtus is that it's not a problem. Rav Shlomo Zalman writes that he doesn't remember anyone ever being worried about anything like this. And the pashtus pshat is it's not a problem. Because if you think about it practically, if they wanted to build a wall in order to separate the holier place from the less holy place, it would be a very bad idea to be mekadesh up until the outer surface. Because then it doesn't really serve as a very good barrier at all. Anyone could just cut. The purpose of the wall is to serve as a barrier. Normally, typically, in the beginning of Maseches Basra, for example, we assume when they built thick walls, they built it like right on the middle line. And the Kedusha starts somewhere right in the middle. So maybe the inner surface, maybe the middle, but Pashup Shad, it's not the outer surface of the wall that actually begins the Kedusha. You also have a further question, whether the Shechina is actually still there. You know, the Binyan Sion quotes a Medrash that says, Shechina lo zaza, but the Gemara in Yuma says that in Mikdash Sheni, we didn't have the Shechina anymore. So what do you mean? Did we not have the Shechina, or did we have the Shechina? So he points out that there are different levels. There are two types of Shechina. There's direct Shechina, and there's indirect Shechina. So we do assume that there is Kedusha there, but still, we're allowed to put our fingers in the wall, and that's why people typically do put notes in the wall. That leads us to the next question. Okay, those notes in the wall, do they have any kedusha? Are they holy? Does something, because you wrote a tefillah, does it become holy? So there was a discussion that really you find a lot as a Sefiras HaOmer discussion, whether ksiva kedibur dam, that, you know, tefillos are holy. So when you write a tefillah, does it have kedusha like a tefillah because ksiva kedibur dami? So Rav Rabinovich has a whole discussion of this in his tshuvos, and Rav Asher Weiss has a whole discussion about this in his tshuvos. And in fact, the main source about ksiva kedibur dami, if you look in all of Shas, the term ksiva kedibur dami does not exist. It was made up by Achronim. It's not even, you don't have it. It doesn't appear. Ksiva kedibur dami came up really mostly at Rabbi Akiva Eger's wedding. Apparently at Rabbi Akiva Eger's wedding, at the rabbi's table at the wedding, they were discussing this issue. They were talking, it was during the time of Sfira. And Rabbi Akiva Eger's wedding, all the tables are probably rabbi's tables, but at one of the rabbi's tables at the wedding, they were discussing this issue. What if, like, you're writing a letter to someone and you write the night of Sfira that it is? Because they used to date their letters by saying what night of Sfira it is. So were you Yotze now? Is Ksiva Kedibor? Is writing like Dibor? So that was a whole discussion in as far as Sfiras HaOmer is concerned. The Ramad discusses, what if you write a tefillah? Can you, does that count as tefillah? By Birchas HaTorah, if you write Torah, Shulchan Aruch says you have to say a Birchas HaTorah before you write down Torah. But the Pasha Pshad, Rav Asher Weiss points this out, is that Ksiva Kedibor has nothing to do with our whole issue. Ksiva Kedibor is, are you yotzei the mitzvah through writing when the mitzvah is to say something? Well, that's not our discussion over here. It's not about being yotzei a mitzvah. Our discussion is this holy? Are these little pieces of paper that say, dear God, please make the Jets finally win the Super Bowl, is that holy because it says, dear God, and I want you to do this for me? Does that make it holy because there's a request from a human being, Takarosh Baruch Hu? So the truth is, I don't know if you ever, you know, for fun, took out notes from the Kotel and started reading them. I have not, but apparently Rav Rabinovich has. So he says that his analysis of the notes yields two types of notes. Some notes, he says, contain psukim, shemos hakadoshim. People actually write out full psukim, they write out shemos Hashem. They're not going to say, dear God. They're going to write out, you know, the 42-letter name of whatever. They're going to write out exactly all the shemos Hashem. You know, this is real. They're right at the Kotel. They're going to say it like it is. So the Gemara in Masechta Shabbos, Daf Kuf Tes Vav, implies that written tefillos are holy. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, old sidurim need to be put in Geniza, certainly because it has Shemos Hashem. So it could very well be that these notes would have Kedusha if they were meant to be. And if you ask most people, I don't think they realize that it's just going to get hosed out of the Kotel within a couple of weeks. I don't know if they assume that like God swallows them or I don't know. I don't think they realize that it's just going to be cleaned up. I don't think they know that. So they're not writing this to be temporary. They're writing this is my permanent tefillah to the Ribono Shel Olam. Then the second type of note is just, you know, personal requests, but no actual Shemos Hashem. There is a Tshuvas HaTashbeit that suggests that a personal request of God also has a certain level of Kedusha. Rav Rabinovich also points out that to just like discard people's heartfelt tefillos is disrespectful. And he says, you know, we should encourage people or discourage people from writing actual names of Hashem or psukim on the papers because they often end up on the floor. But we should treat it with some respect. I don't know how that yielded the result of them hosing them out of the Kotel, but I guess they didn't have any other option. Rav Asher Weiss says he's not bothered by any of this. He thinks that it's only for tefillos with the nusach of the Anshe Knesset HaGadola. That's a tefillah that has Kedusha. But you're just going to say, you know, whatever, dear God, please do this for me. Nah, it doesn't have Kedusha. God listens to such tefillos. It's a sincere form of tefillah, but it doesn't give the paper a sense of Kedusha. You know, for example, Rav Asher says, let's say a person, Rachman al-Utzlan, slips in the shower and no one's home and they can't get up. Are they allowed to offer a mental prayer to help them out? So, of course you're allowed to. You're allowed to think about God wherever you are. That's what Rav Asher suggests, even though it's not so clear in Achronim that that's in fact true. But he said, because that's not a tefillah of Kedusha, it's just a tefillah because, of course, you believe in God. And he says, even the Tashbitz is proof about tefillos having Kedusha, that's only when you wrote down Shmona Esrei or something like that. So therefore, he thinks that we don't have to worry about the Kedusha of these tefillos. The question is there any reason to do it? You know, there is a source from the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, that the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh apparently sent a note to be put into the Kotel. But short of that, other than that, we don't really find, Rav Shlomo Zalman says he never remembers Gedolim doing this, Rav Asher Weiss says they never remember the big people who visited the Kotel putting notes in the Kotel. Who puts a note in the Kotel? Politicians. You know, when the president goes to visit the Kotel, he'll put a note in the Kotel. But it's not something that has to be done. It's not forbidden to do, but it's not something that has to be done. Okay, so now we've got the notes in the Kotel. We know that they're going to be dealt with however they're going to be dealt with. So now we move on to the next thing, which is chiseling off pieces of the Kotel. I actually skipped one. All right, we'll maybe get back to it later. I skipped the Kotel Plaza. But chiseling off pieces of the Kotel. The Rav Rabinovich writes in his tshuva, he says, Litza'ari, he starts his tshuva, to my great pain, Ba'achrona bo'u elai anashim shesipru li, people came to me and told me, Sheyesh habayim lekotel umenatkim me'avnei hakotel chatichot ketanot. There are people that come and cut off little pieces. V'notun lebeisam kaveyachol kiskula la'atzlacha. And they take this as a skula for atzlacha in what they do. There was one mukubal apparently that was going around saying that if you put it under a pregnant woman's pillow, she'll have an easy labor. All sorts of different skulas that they have for these things. Ukadoma. They frame it. And it's an act of tzidkus. Look how connected I am to Yerushalayim and to Kedusha. Look, it's Alas Yerushalayim al Rosh Simchasi, etc. So he says, how awful this is. Elu sha'ovrim b'shat nefesh al kama v'kama isurim. He says, these people are violating many isurim. So which ones? What avera are they violating? So, first of all, it may be a violation of Me'ila. At any time, which is a tough one to violate nowadays because we don't have any Hekdesh anymore. So it's, if you want to win the Avera contest and be creative, so this would be a good one because no one else can really violate it. There's nothing that's Hekdesh anymore. But we do have this one thing that's Kadosh. We still have the wall, so you chisel off a piece of that wall. It could be a violation of Me'ila. But wait, is it really Me'ila? What's Me'ila? Me'ila is when you get Hana'ah from Hekdesh. What are they doing with it? They're just taking it. They're not getting any hana'ah from it. So Rabinovich says, yes, they are. Of course they're getting hana'ah from it. They're getting hana'ah from the fact that they get to show it off to everybody. And Rav Moshe writes, Me'ila from Hekdesh could be violated in two ways. It could be from getting hana'ah from Hekdesh or from stealing from Hekdesh, meaning taking something out of the Rishus of Hekdesh, bringing it into your own Rishus. That too is Me'ila, even if you don't get hana'ah from it. So number one is Me'ila. Number two, Lo sasun kein la'ashem elokeichem. The Torah tells us you go into Eretz Yisrael, you're going to find Avodah Zarah all over the place. And you have an obligation to destroy that Avodah Zarah. Oh, and by the way, don't do that to Hashem. What do you mean don't do that to Hashem? Of course you can't do that to Hashem. No, the Torah is telling us symbols of Kedusha, things that are that are imbued with Kedusha, you are not permitted to destroy. So it's a destruction of the property of Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash. Furthermore, Es Mikdash Aitirau. A person should be taken with a certain sense of mora when they come to the Makom HaMikdash. Rav Zilberstein adds on, Bizayon va'ose maisa Titus. Says, you're acting like Titus HaRasha, who was interested, who's the one that stabbed the parochas, so we read all these figures prominently in the Kinos on Tisha B'Av, when a person decides to chisel off a piece of the kotel. And he says, if you're using it for a skula, then you're also in violation of the iser of misrape b'divrei Torah. That you're not allowed to use divrei Torah as a refuah, and over here you're using a davar shel kedusha as a refuah. Okay, he's reaching a little bit on that one. But still, it's a violation of many isurim. So chiseling off a piece of the kotel, not okay. Let's go back to the Kotel Plaza, though. Because the Kotel Plaza is an interesting one. You see, when I go to Eretz Yisrael, for the past several years already, it's always to visit all the different yeshivas. And if you, I'm sure Rabbi Kamenetsky and Rabbi Storch can relate to this, when you go to visit the yeshivos, you're going to get HaKotel and Nativ on the same day, because it's bad planning if you don't get them both on the same day. So you're going to schedule your shir for both of them on the same day. How do you get from HaKotel to Nativ? So maybe Rabbi Kamenetsky and Rabbi Storch cannot relate to this. I have a terrible sense of direction. So there are ways to easily just get from HaKotel to Nativ through the back streets, if like there's a kid that will take you. But I can't. So I go down to the Kotel and go back up the stairs, and that's what I get from a Kotel to Nativ. Are you allowed to do that? Meaning the Kotel, the halacha is, the Gemara in Brachos says, I actually just taught it right here in the Beis Medrash the other day, that one is not allowed to make make a Beis HaKnesses a shortcut. So if one is not allowed to make a Beis HaKnesses into a shortcut, does the Kotel Plaza have the status of the of a Beis HaKnesses? In which case, you're not allowed to use it as a shortcut. It's a fascinating sugya in halacha, because certainly the lower plaza has the status of a Beis HaKnesses. There's no doubt that the lower plaza has the status of a Beis HaKnesses. In fact, when Rav Zilberstein discusses the issue of cutting the grass from between the wall, between the stones of the Kotel, the reason Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld told people, and the reason they had this tradition not to cut it, was that it should promote a sense of agmas nefesh. People should come to the Kotel and say, look how unkempt it is, look how dirty it is, that there's even grass growing out of it. Oy vey, this is Churban. And Rabbi Zilberstein said that his father-in-law, Rabbi Eliashiv, disagreed entirely with that. He said, no, just like a place of, there's a halach in the Gemara, that a Beis HaKnesses Shecharav, if there was a Beis HaKnesses that was destroyed and the grass is growing, let it grow, let it become overgrown, let people have a sense of Agmas Nefesh. How did we allow that to happen? That's true. But there's also a halacha that if you have a shul that's functioning and is working and people are davening in, you need to take care of it. You need to clean it and you need to make sure that it's respectful. So whereas Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld said, leave the grass there, let everyone appreciate Korban, Rav Eliashiv said, clean it up. It's the world's biggest shul. You have to keep it clean, you have to keep it nice, because you're in the world's biggest shul. So we don't think of the Kotel that way, we think of it as this holy place that we go to daven, but normally a holy place that you go to daven, we have a word for that. It's a shul. So that's exactly what the Kotel Plaza is. The bottom plaza is definitely a shul. Thank God you can't really use it as a shortcut to anything. So we don't have that issue. But in terms of the way one should behave in shul, in terms of the cell phones and everything else, or whatever other issues there are, in terms of how to behave in a shul, so one should behave that way by the Kotel Plaza as well. At least that way. But what about the upper plaza? The upper plaza is an interesting sugya in halacha. The Gemara Maseches Megillah tells us that there was a machlokas between Rabbi Nachman, Rabbi Yossi, and the Chachamim, whether a rechova shel ir has kedusha. What's a rechova shel ir? The town square where everyone gathers when they have major events. When they used to have a siyum hashas, where would everyone gather? They didn't have football stadiums yet. So where did people go? They went to the largest place they had, and that's where everyone got together. So when they had like a major day of tefillah, they called everyone together to rechova shel ir. So Rabbi Nachman, Rabbi Yossi says, it has kedusha. Because you daven there, b'tainios ma'amados. At unique times, special times, where the crowds are too big for any shul, they use that as a place of tefillah. Whereas the Rabbanan say, no, it doesn't have kedusha because it's only used ba'akroi ba'alma. Only once in a while people gather there to daven. Typically it's not used for tefillah. The Rambam in Hilchos Tefillah paskins like the Chachamim. However, so that would be great. Like Chacham, so it doesn't have kedusha. So the upper plaza, l'chora, is just like the Rechava Shalir. When do they use the upper plaza for tefillah? Birchas Kohanim. When the lower plaza gets so crowded, so sometimes it goes back, on Tisha B'Av, I think that's where the NCSY Kol does the kumsitz for the entire world. Right? When it gets so crowded, so then, the crowd goes back. And there's tefillah that happens in the upper plaza. So it's exactly that machlokas tanayim. However, the Bir Halacha says, not sure. Because there could be a difference between a rechova shel ir, the town square, versus, let's say, the azara of a Beis HaKnesses, the courtyard of a Beis HaKnesses. A lot of times in shuls also, there's an overflow crowd. So, there's two yard sites or something. So they have one guy davening in the shul, and then they have another one out in the hall. There's too much of a crowd, they have a second minion out in the hall. But that hallway minion can actually see inside the shul. It's actually exposed to the inside of the shul. It opens up right into the shul. It could be that if there's a minug to daven there on a somewhat regular basis, it could be that that gives it some sense of kedusha. The Rambam writes, Rechova Shalir, Afal Pisha Am Espalin Bo, the Rechova Shalir, even though people daven there on Tainos Ma'amados, and the Beis HaKnesses can't hold them, Ein Bo Kedusha Mibnei Shehu Arai. And he says, V'chein Batim V'chatzeru Sha'am Eschansim Lahem L'tfila, any place where people gather to daven, as long as it's not kavua litfila, it's only arai, you don't have any kedusha. The Shulchan Aruch says in bem shum kedusha, but nevertheless the Bir Halacha wasn't sure about this. He thought that maybe if it opens up directly in, maybe it does have some kedusha. So Rav Zsolti, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim, thought also that it has more kedusha than Rechova Shalir, and therefore we should treat it with respect. Not necessarily the full respect of a Beis HaKnesses, but with a greater sense of dignity than you would any other street in Yerushalayim. So what does that mean? So he thought, a shortcut? Okay, you could use it as a shortcut. You're trying to get from Yeshiva HaKotel to Tivarie, you don't have to sit down and say a pasuk or something, and it's okay, you're allowed to pass by. It still feels weird. You want to stop and like say a kapitel dilim or something, but you're allowed to use it as a shortcut. But to use it as a place to socialize, he thought that's not appropriate. Rav Asher Weiss also writes that Kivan Sharachava Pesucha rather Kenegad HaKosel, it's open to the Kosel, Yesh LaHachmir, but we should be more Machmir about it. And he says especially not to treat it as a place of what he calls Hamakom Bitaroves Anashim V'Nashim, and it should not be treated in an inappropriate manner. However, Rav Nevensal, who's really the Mara Da'asra, holds that it doesn't have any Kedusha and you can use it as a shortcut. I don't think he thinks people should socialize there, but that's a different story. I don't know if that relates to its Kedusha, but he holds that that one is certainly allowed to use it as a shortcut. As far as going on Har HaBayis, I'm going to have to make a long story short over here because we're running out of time. Going on Har HaBayis is a long story, actually, but Rav Shechter once gave a shiur here in this very spot about going on Har HaBayis, the Zman HaZeh. What was fascinating about his conclusion, well, before we get to his conclusion, some basic knowledge, basic information. A person who's Tamei Meis is allowed to enter Har HaBayis. So we are all Tamei Meisim. That does not preclude us, that does not keep us off of Har HaBayis. A person who is a Zav, Zava, Balkari, Nida, Yoledes, any of the other forms of Tumah which we might have is not permitted on Har HaBayis. So the thing is, we have no way to get rid of Tumas Meis, but that's no problem. We're allowed on Har HaBayis even though we're Tamei Meis. We do have ways to get rid of, for example, Tumas Nida or Tumas Balkari. There's something called the mikvah. A person goes to the mikvah, or Tumas Ziva even, a person goes to Mayan and is Tovel. So we can get rid of such Tumos, and then maybe go on to the Har HaBayis once we get rid of such Tumos. However, for a variety of reasons, some public policy and some halachic, the majority of the poskim in Eretz Yisrael have assumed for decades that it's not proper to go on to Har HaBayis, whether it be because we're not sure exactly where everything is and it's going to be hard to keep people off Makom HaZara, or whether it's because the Har HaBayis has a certain Kedusha, and just like the halacha is in a shul, you're not allowed to go into a shul just stam to go in. You have to go in with a purpose to do something holy in the shul. So you have to go into daven. So what? You can go in Har HaBayis and you're a daven, and that could be bad. You have to be very careful with what you do on Har HaBayis. So whether it's for that reason, or whether it's for a reason, you know, we're going to interview everybody. Are you Balkeri? Are you Nida? Are you? It's going to be very, very difficult to police something like that. For that reason and for others, there's one of the more creative reasons someone suggested is Chazal where goes there, that in Am Haaretz, that anyone who's not familiar with the laws of Tumah Tahara has the status of a Zav. So one of the Achronim suggested, so you can go to the mikvah or go to the Mayan and you lose, you can take care of your Ziva, but if Chazal were made a Gzera that every Am Haaretz has the status of a Zav, after you go to the mikvah, you may not be a Zav anymore, but you know what you still are? An Am Haaretz, so you're a Zav again. So there's no way to get rid of it. So, okay, that's a bit of a humorous suggestion, but at the end of the day, there are strong arguments to be made in either direction. Also, it is important to realize, Rav Shechter always points out, if we can go, we should go. Meaning, if you hold that you can go, then we need to make a statement that this is important enough to us that we will go. Rabbi Tendler has a shtick that he goes, and every time he goes, he rips off some leaves from a tree to be mekayim in the mitzvah of taking away kol eitz on mizbech Hashem, takes away a little bit of a tree, a mitzvah mitzvah, and then he burns it and uses it as the ashes on the head of a chassan. But here's where Rav Shechter doesn't go. Rav Shechter said that at the end of the day, he thinks that there's enough reason to go, that you'd be allowed to go, but he says he finds it very annoying when a major issue comes up in America, and every rabbi in Israel has an opinion of what's going on here in America. They don't know the climate here in America. They don't know what's going on. They don't know the sensitivities we have here in America. It's not their business to mix into our issues in America. He said he thinks equally it's not our business to mix into their issues in Eretz Yisrael. People are much more familiar with what kind of repercussions that would have. He thought that it's up to them to make that determination. I just want to close with something similar to what I began with. I was listening recently to Rav Moshe Weinberger, who's going to be speaking here next week. We spoke at the beginning about HaKadosh Baruch Hu being Meitzitz Min HaCharakim. Rav Moshe Weinberger told the story that Michael Levy told I think at some point about his childhood. He was Rabbi Willig's. He is Rabbi Willig's brother-in-law, and he's blind. And as a child, his mother was always very, very nervous about him. You know, can you let him play? Is he gonna know where to go? And she would always accompany him every day to school. And he was getting a little older, and it was getting embarrassing that she was accompanying him each and every day to school. And he said, look, I know how many steps each block is. I know how to ask someone to help me cross the street. I could feel along the whole way the fence and the light pole. And I know I've trained it. I've rehearsed it 1,000 times in my mind and every day. Please let me go alone. Let me walk alone to school. And his mother said, no, no, no. And finally, one day, she said, okay, you can go alone to school. And he was so excited. He felt like $1 million. And he was walking, and he felt the fence. And he had it down to a science. He had it perfect. And he got to that last street, and he asked someone to help him. And they crossed the street, and he sees the security guard. And the security guard says, good morning, Michael. And then he hears the security guard say, good morning, Mrs. Levy. And Rav Moshe Weinberger uses this as a mashal for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his relationship with us. There are times over the last 50 years where we realized that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was watching over us and was right with us. Those moments in 1967, every time you read about them, every time you see footage of it, tears. And there are moments where we think, this Geula process is going way too slowly. Is it ever finally going to happen? But our chizik, we have to remember, is that we are headed in the right direction. And the fact that we're able to talk about the halachos that we spoke about tonight is a very great bracha. It's not the ultimate bracha, but it's a very great bracha. And Emir Tzashem, this will be the beginning of the discussion next year of the halachos of not visiting the Kotel, but of visiting the Beis HaMikdash.